done.
Woo! Welcome. Yeah.
This is Hope. In today's episode of According to Your Purpose, we have Abigail Favale. Abigail is a writer and professor who has a specialty in feminism and gender studies. We got the chance to talk about the origins of transgenderism and its effects on society today. Here's my talk with Abigail. Well, Abigail, thank you for doing this. I just finished your book. I was up late last night and I finished your book, and it was amazing. I think it's a constructive vision of a way forward with a lot of things that are being talked about, whether it be gender or feminism. But to get started, I would love to go over your background, because I think your background actually will make people that are maybe hesitant to deal with this topic, or maybe they are dealing with it, maybe more receptive to the things that you're saying. So I think a good place to start would be your background. How did you get into this? How did you find yourself in this position where you're writing a book like this?
Sure. So to go a little bit back in time, I have an academic background in gender studies. So when I studied philosophy as an undergrad, and then when I went to graduate school, I did a master's degree in women's writing and gender theory, and then a PhD that really used a lot of feminist theory and gender theory as part of my analysis. Prior to that, you know, to go way back, I grew up as an evangelical Christian in the Western United States. And I think I've always been somewhat interested in gender, or at least what it means to be embodied as a boy or a girl. I mean, I remember even just as a kid, I would anthropomorphize everything, like, you know, the forks and the spoons or like toothbrushes, like everything became a person, right? So I've just been very interested in persons. And in my own kind of individual, I guess, particularity, I, on the one hand, liked being a girl and thought it was a positive thing. But then on the other hand, I was often not very girly, and I often found myself in more male-dominated spaces and trying to kind of figure out what it meant to be a woman when I wasn't often the typical woman. So by the time I got to college, I wanted to really begin to study these topics in earnest. And that's when I really got into feminist philosophy, feminist biblical criticism, feminist theology. And I just cannonballed right in the deep end on that. Because I thought this will help me resolve all my questions. You know, this is what I've been looking for. And what I found out was that the more immersed I became in gender studies, specifically gender theory and feminist philosophy, the more I kind of absorbed the dominant worldview that's there, which I tend to call, just for simplicity's sake, a postmodern worldview. And this happened without me consciously realizing it. You know, it wasn't like I was sitting down and really reflecting and thought, you know, I think I'm now intellectually convinced that we can't really know truth. You know, I never had a moment like that. But rather, I just kind of absorbed, those were the waters I was swimming in, and that's eventually just how I began to see the world. So for most of my 20s, when I was really heavily into this area academically, my faith kind of diminished into almost nothing, I would say. I think I still considered myself a Christian, but there was nothing, I wasn't practicing anything. I wasn't praying. I wasn't going to church. There was no like lived out reality of my faith. It was just this kind of, I just dissertated about things. And I also had kind of moved away from this idea of any kind of authority that had some kind, that was able to speak into my life and to put limits on me, because by then I saw Christianity, scripture, God even, as, you know, stories that human beings create. And those things couldn't really speak truth into our lives, right? Anyway, and then I had a reversion back to the faith, specifically to Catholic Christianity, after I became a mother for the first time. And so now in my work, I try to bring my insider knowledge and in-depth knowledge of gender theory, gender studies, feminist philosophy, to help Christians better understand some of what's going on behind the words we're using increasingly in our time, and to just help people of faith navigate these issues, which have become so complex and tricky to navigate.
So you had a period of time when you were teaching pro-gender studies, you were on board with everything going on, and then you had a change of heart through teaching. Is that when it happened? You were kind of in the middle of teaching kids and you're saying this is a net positive on the world. What changed your mind to kind of make you go in the other direction?
Right. So yeah, there definitely was a time when, you know, gender studies is a very, I would say, I try to not to use the word ideology because I think it tends to be a little overused and is often too simplistic. But I will say that gender studies is an ideological discipline in the sense that it comes with a set of ideological commitments, almost like its own kind of dogma. And if you're not in line with the dogmas, then you're kind of a heretic. So there was a time when I was, you know, a very good gender theorist, and I followed all the dogmas of reality, gender, language being social constructs, God is a social construct, all those sorts of things. We perform our gender, it doesn't really exist. I taught those things and believed those things. But it was in my process of coming back to faith that, I mean, one thing about ideological thinking is that it's kind of a bubble, like it's this totalizing narrative, and you just read everything through that lens. And that's something about feminist philosophy and gender theory, is that it's also a method. And you like apply this method, this way of interpretation, onto a text or whatever. And there are no surprises, really, because you have the quote-unquote truth, because there is no truth. So that method of deconstruction is the only truth, and you're bringing that to everything. So it's very difficult to actually be surprised by anything that you read, or to suddenly be humbled by something and think, wow, I never thought about that before. I might be wrong about something. So I began to go through a period, I think, where my ideological bubble was beginning to crack. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that I became a mother for the first time. And there were just questions now about my life that I was asking. And so the feminism was beginning to lose its explanatory power over my experience. And so I just began to ask questions. And once I stepped into that space of just beginning to ask genuine questions, I started to realize that some of these theories that I was studying and teaching, they don't really hold up to scrutiny. If you know, gender theory, at least in kind of the Judith Butler mode, is very radically social constructionist to the point of being almost anti-realist. So there is what we think of as reality is a construct of language, and we can't really know what's real. You know, and that way of thinking is not only antithetical to Christianity or any religion, but it's also antithetical to things like science, you know, and any real body of knowledge that makes truth claims. And that's just not how human beings think and interact with the world. You know, I really think Aristotle's right when he says that all human beings by their nature desire to know. Like that's how we're created. That's the kind of beings that we are. And we interact with the world as if it's intelligible, as if it has meaning that can be known, at least in part, right? I do think this is like kind of a side note, but one thing that the postmodernists get right is this kind of suspicion toward the Enlightenment certainty, you know, that we can kind of reduce anything worth knowing down to a scientific experiment. There is also this mystery behind things, right? So God, for example, is real and can be known, but not fully comprehended by the human mind, right? So that's kind of where I land.
I was not aware of the connection between feminism and gender ideology or transgenderism of any sort. Why don't we start for people? So this is kind of fresh. I've had a guest on previously. And if you're listening to this and you're confused, you should go listen to our episode with Richard Weikart. He was a historian and he kind of tracks through different philosophers in different periods of time and how they valued human life. And we got into a little bit of the Michel Foucault stuff. Would you mind going through feminism and the different waves and kind of what each one kind of stood for? Because there's multiple points in here that I was shocked, because it's not really the pitch that you get on these people when you hear like the history class version of it. It's very different than what their foundational philosophy is.
Yeah. So, well, one thing that's interesting is that I don't think feminist thought has a foundational philosophy. I think that feminist thought tends to be grafted onto other philosophical approaches. So to explain further, let's look at the first wave of feminism, right? So the first wave of feminism happened in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it really adopted the values of philosophical liberalism, right? And it sought equal rights within the liberal state. So there wasn't a sense that we have to sort of dismantle the social order. Rather, we need to give women full access in the existing political order. So the right to vote, the right to have some custodial rights over their own children, the right to have representation on juries, to be admitted into higher institutes of education, those sorts of things. And once the right to vote was won, feminism pretty much went dormant. So that was around 1920. And that's where the waves metaphor comes from, because there really is this long lull between the first wave and the second wave, which starts in the late 1960s. So we have a gap almost of, 40 years or so. And a whole world war in between, right? And that's something I think it's interesting, actually, that activist movements back then tended to have a specific goal that they wanted to achieve. And then once that goal was achieved, they would disband, right? They would say, good job, people. Let's go back to our normal lives, right? But now we have almost this industry that comes up around activism. People's jobs become wrapped up in it, their organizations, right? And so then when you achieve a specific goal, you have to kind of immediately pivot and find the next thing, right? So that's just this kind of a side note. But the second wave feminism, I think, has a more complex attachments to different forms of philosophy. But I would say it was pretty heavily influenced by Marxism, which was kind of more prominent philosophically at that time. And that's when you have kind of the women's liberation movement, and you even have these little consciousness raising groups, right? So there's this sense of women as a class, women as a collective that need to then sort of overthrow the patriarchy, right? So we almost have this Marxist framing where you have the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, but then for the feminists, it's women and then the patriarchy.
Is the patriarchy not prevalent in the first wave?
No.
Okay.
No, that's what's interesting. So there is not in the first wave this conception of this kind of bogeyman of male supremacy. There were certainly very real kind of grievances about how women don't have equality in society. But there wasn't a sense that like men as a class are this oppressor. So this idea of the patriarchy and patriarchal oppression really comes, I think, much more in second wave feminism. And second wave feminism is also when the feminist movement becomes allied with the pro-abortion movement. So similarly, first wave feminists were not in general pro-abortion or even pro-contraception. So they had very conventional views about, they thought the solution to regulating birth was male chastity. So, which I happen to think is a great idea. Anyway, so, but then in the second wave, we get this alliance with abortion and then contraception, right? So that's another difference. The first wave of feminism predates the shift to being a contraceptive society and the invention of the birth control pill. Whereas second wave feminism erupts into a place where the birth control pill has been invented and is now being legalized. And then abortion becomes legalized as well through second wave feminism. So then in the 80s, feminism kind of devolves into this internecine conflict, which is often referred to as the feminist sex wars. So basically they split over the question of whether things like pornography and prostitution are oppressive to women or whether they are somehow empowering, right? So you have the so-called sex positive feminists who are arguing that if women choose to be sex workers, or if women kind of choose to be involved in pornography, that that sexual liberation is liberating. And then you had the quote unquote sex negative feminists who were like, yeah, no, that's just a different form of patriarchal oppression. So in the middle of these sex wars, then you kind of see the third wave of feminism erupting. And I think third wave feminism, which really kind of carries on through the 90s, really embraces that sex positive, again, in quotes, and that kind of sexual libertine, like, just, you know, there's like this Onion article. I can't remember when it came out, but it was something like, the headline was like, women now empowered by everything they do.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit like third wave feminism. Like, wow, as long as we're like choosing things, like we're awesome. And, but in the late 80s and early 90s, that's when Judith Butler comes onto the scene. So here's a little more kind of philosophical distinctions between second wave feminism that would be helpful here. So for second wave feminists, the word gender refers to social norms and constructs that are associated with biological sex, right? So sex refers to biology, and gender refers to social norms, right? Like, for example, it would be, you know, the fact that my hair is long right now, that's more of a gender norm than this like strictly biological thing, right? It's not like my hair grows longer, right? But so that's the sex gender split, right? But when Judith Butler comes onto the scene, she's the first one to make the argument that not only is gender a social construct, but sex itself is a social construct. So our tendency to project this category of male and female onto human bodies is a social invention, not a matter of nature or fact. So for Judith Butler, nothing is natural. There's no such thing as human nature. And I would say that that's that idea that there's no such thing as nature, human nature, has been a big strand in feminism, even before Butler. But she was the first one to really basically say everything's gender, even what we tend to call sex. So she really sweeps away that sex gender split, and gender then becomes this like Pac-Man monster that just kind of swallows up everything.
How does she divorce that from biological sex?
Well, she says that they're both social constructs, right? So she says biological sex isn't actually real. Like, that's just a name that, so we say it exists, and so then we think it's real, but it's not, right? So she might say something like, why not categorize human beings according to hair color? You know, why categorize them according to these, you know, kind of physical characteristics that really aren't that meaningful? Now, of course, like, the obvious elephant in the room here is like, well, because these particular physical characteristics are the only ones capable of bringing new human beings into the world, right? So that kind of raises the stakes. But she's really kind of wanting to step away from that. So her entire philosophical project is about dismantling heteronormativity. So dismantling the idea that heterosexual relations are somehow natural. So that's what she really wants to disrupt. So she disrupts that by disrupting the idea of sex itself.
I guess one of the confusing parts for me when I was reading this was there was a few different moments, right? So the first moment being birth control. And on its face, you think birth control is good. It gives women some control over their bodies. But when you're thinking about the implications of that, what it's really done, it's preferenced male's tendency towards sex, right? Is that it's not really protective of females. It's just, it's more generous towards what males are like, oh, like, this is great. And that doesn't feel particularly feminist. And then you move in further. So that's like what, that was second wave, right? So that's like Margaret Sanger. Then you have the third wave, which would be Judith Butler. And she's saying there's nothing inherently, there's no meaning at all in the body. There's no meaning communicated through anything biological. I don't understand how it didn't stop with the second wave. I don't even know how it got to the third wave that women were interested in this as a as an ideology that was meant, I guess, in its base form, its first wave form, to protect them, to give them some semblance of like basic, you know, rights or whatever it may be. It doesn't feel particularly feminine or protective of females at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. So one of the arguments I make is that feminism, ironically, at least since the second wave, has had a masculine bias. So basically, it is said that for women, what empowerment or freedom looks like is to become as much like a man as possible, specifically adopting the male reproductive norm. So basically getting rid of that problem that female bodies have of getting pregnant. And that's really what's the word, like inheritance of Margaret Sanger. So when Margaret Sanger started her pro birth control movement in the early 20th century, the idea of birth control was very socially unacceptable. Like, eugenics was great. Everyone was on board with eugenics, right?
Yeah.
Because she was very much a eugenicist. But then her birth control advocacy was much more controversial. Now, of course, the reverse is true, right? We're like, yay, birth control, maybe not eugenics. But for her, she really explicitly in her writings, if you look at what she wrote, she scapegoats the female body for everything that's wrong with the world. The fact that there's poverty, oppression, even tyranny, you can all trace it back to the fact that women have babies. And because they're not regulating the fact that they have babies or controlling the fact that they have babies, then they're, you know, causing all this harm. So she scapegoats femaleness for that. And that value system is really adopted by feminism. So feminism, since the second wave, I think, has a very ambivalent relationship to femaleness, to gestation, lactation, these aspects of the female body that make obvious our interdependent nature as human beings. And I think the reason why it's been so successful, even though it is so negative toward femaleness, is that we really do live in a culture that does not really know what to do with women. You know, that I think it's that even just the liberal social state, I guess, or the liberal political state, it's very much about the autonomous individual, and freedom is seen as having as few limits as possible on my freedom. And the only limits are when they impinge on other people's freedom, right? But even the phenomenon of pregnancy doesn't translate well into a discussion of individual rights, because you have two persons sharing a body, essentially. You have two, you know, in this symbiotic relationship. So I think the fact is, you know, it's in our culture, the right to abortion was won before legal protections against being fired for being pregnant. And we still don't have decent maternity leave in the United States. So there just hasn't been much social change to actually accommodate the realities of pregnancy. Instead, it's just been, well, we need to free women from pregnancy. And so I think a lot of women have just absorbed those values, right? Because those are the values of our culture.
Yeah, it's like Amazon tweeting, we will pay to fly you out to get an abortion because we support women. It's like, or you could just pay for them to have the baby. That would be
right. Yeah. Give decent maternity leave, yeah. You know, because the fact is, like, for most women who have abortions, like, it's a profoundly difficult choice. Like, it's not, you know, it is, even among people who might say like, oh, it was no big deal or whatever. But, you know, it is, I would argue, it does violence, not just to the unborn child, but to the woman and her own body. And it pits a woman against her offspring, you know, and there is something deeply unnatural about that, right? So I very much want to rehabilitate the idea of nature. I think we do have a human nature. In fact, I think it's God-given, and that, you know, like, this kind of Aristotelian idea that happiness is found in fulfilling our nature, in working with our nature rather than against it and pushing against its limits.
Did you find that you had changed your mind on women before you came back to your faith? Was it the change in your mind around feminism that led you back towards like the, you know, Aristotelian idea of function and purpose, and then trying to backwards your way back into religion?
Yeah. So, okay. If I can, like, I think if I had to lay it out chronologically, although eventually they all were kind of happening together, I would say that it was becoming a mother to a son specifically, right? So not only just experiencing kind of the full reality of my femaleness and realizing, wow, sexual difference isn't a construct, crazily enough, right? Like, this is, my body has, it's kind of designed to do something really powerful. And, you know, I'm just along for the ride when that happens, right? When you're like giving birth or lactating or whatever. And then also becoming a mother to a son and being kind of newly interested in what men experience, what boys experience, how our culture is in some ways not good for men either. And once I began to ask those questions, that just really disrupts the tidy narrative of women as victims, men as oppressors. Like the idea that in any given situation, women are always in a disadvantage in relation to men. I just started questioning that. And once I started questioning that, that's when things began to shift. And once I think my, because basically, to put it simply, feminism had become my religion. And once I began to, have some distance from that, it was no longer this kind of religious fervor, but became much more of an open intellectual exploration. Then that, I think, created room for the spiritual angst that I'd been feeling for also a decade that I'd kind of been suppressing to come to the surface. And then I pretty quickly became Catholic. I mean, it was just sort of a crazy thing. And then it was actually in that process of coming back to the faith, but then also I started teaching in a Great Books program, like, providentially at the same time. So it was also this time of intellectual renewal, because also during this time, I just began to get bored with the feminist methodology of reading. Like, you bring your conclusions with you. You know, it's like I crack open Plato and I already know I'm going to conclude that he's sexist. I just have to find out where, you know, and that just becomes a really boring way of reading the world. And that's not to say there isn't sometimes sexism in a text and it can be beneficial to talk about it. But once I moved away from that way of reading, it was like this whole new world opened up and I was like, wow, there's so much to learn. I could read Plato and actually think about what justice is, or think about the nature of the good and the, you know, the analogy of the cave. You know, it just was really this time of kind of discovery and openness. And that happened to coincide with a return to the faith as well. So, you know, and that's something I think you might hear someone say, oh, well, she just traded one ideology for another, right? So she traded the kind of feminist, postmodern feminist ideology for a Catholic ideology. But the difference is that when I was a feminist ideologue, it really closed down truth seeking. There wasn't even like a truth to seek, really. But now, as a Catholic, I'm working within a particular tradition, but because that tradition wants to seek out truth wherever it is found, I don't have this, like, you know, having the conclusion before I even begin to read something, right? Like, there's much more of a sense of discovery and formation and openness. Like, I can ask questions now. You know, sometimes Christians get a bad rap, like, you're not supposed to ask questions and they're anti-intellectual. But I think actually I experienced that more when I was really in the kind of feminist academic bubble than I do now.
Yeah. And postmodern people tend to define themselves in opposition. It's not a creative type of intellectual worldview. It's very much a, like, a deconstructing worldview where we take the existing forms of order and explain why they're wrong. Well, it's like, well, what do you offer in replacement? And they don't really have a good offer to replace it.
You just dismantle. Yeah.
Getting back to Judith Butler, why did she want to get rid of the family structure? Why is family in opposition to feminism?
Well, I mean, I don't want to like psychoanalyze Judith Butler.
Go for it.
Okay, so she is, I mean, she is a lesbian, right? So she's working from kind of her own experience of sexual desire and then wanting to argue against this idea that that's somehow unnatural, right? So, you know, that's kind of maybe the starting point for her. And she's very heavily influenced by Michel Foucault. You said you talked about that on an earlier podcast. Once you enter a paradigm where truth, where knowledge is a social construct, that basically removes, that dismantles any idea of norms, right? And that, for queer theory especially, which Judith Butler is seen as one of the central figures of queer theory, that's the whole project, is dismantling norms, questioning norms, queering norms, right? So any norm is seen as almost, because power itself is seen as inherently negative, inherently oppressive. There isn't a sense of just power or unjust power. It's that this power that's constructing this language is bad. And so we need to disrupt the power structures. We need to disrupt the language. We need to disrupt the norms. But what's fascinating to see is that, you know, fast forward 20, 30 years, what do we see? We see the disruption of norms, but also the erection of new norms. Like, there's so many more norms now. Now there's norms around which words you can use, which words you can't. There's new labels and categories that are around identity that are very strictly policed. That's actually not really a Judith Butler approach at all. You know, so what's fascinating is she cleared the deck for norms around gender and sex. But what we've seen is that in that absence of norms, we have activists just creating new norms. And those new norms are changing all the time. I think that's one reason why people feel just confused within this conversation is that things are changing so quickly and the terminology is constantly morphing, because there's no there, right? So here's another, this is kind of another aspect of postmodern, especially politics, is this idea that, okay, well, if we're not working with a sense of the real and knowledge and truth are kind of human constructs, well, then it doesn't really matter if the language you use is true. You use the language that you want that has a specific political end to it. And then if it becomes no longer politically efficacious, you switch the words because it doesn't matter, right? Because they're not actually rooted in anything true. So that's actually kind of not necessarily a bug, but a feature of postmodern politics, is this constant evolution, this constant change, this constant disruption, disrupting norms, then setting new norms, then those norms changing.
Is the thinking that there's just nothing beyond power? It's just all power at the bottom level?
Yep.
Interesting.
Yes.
I saw a video sometime this week. I'm sure you saw it if you're on Twitter. But it was a trans woman, a man who thinks he is a woman, saying that he was more of a woman than a physical woman because he had thought about the concept of being a woman while biological women had not thought about the concept. And it was when I was reading a lot of this Judith Butler, and it sounds to me that it was like a direct outgrowth of her worldview that nothing is natural. It's only how you personally define it. Do you see that direct connection?
You know, I think that people often use the term gender ideology, and I avoid that term for a couple of reasons. One, because I think it's not really helpful for dialogue, but also because I think it's a little bit reductive, because the truth is there's a lot of different ideologies coexisting, right? So you might have someone who takes a very Butlerian or queer theory approach to it, which is basically like, look, woman is just a social construct. This is literally just this social category that anyone can appropriate. And because I've consciously appropriated it, it's more authentic for me. You know, so that you could see someone making that argument. It sounds like this person made that argument. But then you also have this narrative that within each of us, there's this mystical thing called a gender identity. And it is so profoundly true and real that young children can know what their gender identity is. And if there is any kind of incongruence with your sex, then you need to change your body in radical ways in order to accommodate that gender identity. And not only is this kind of mystical soul, this kind of mystical sense of gender identity, not socially constructed, it might even be at odds with your socialization, right? So a child who's male, who's being raised as a boy, might say, actually, I'm a girl, right? So he's actually resisting the socialization. So that's a very different understanding of gender, okay? But those two things, those two concepts, so gender as gender identity, this essentialist gender identity, and then gender as this empty social construct that anyone can appropriate, those are very different concepts. But they're being offered simultaneously, sometimes by the same organization or person. You know, they'll shift from gender as social construct to gender as gender identity. And so that equivocation, I think, is also making a lot of problems. And the gender identity concept is very different from what Judith Butler was arguing. But I think her philosophy enabled that to evolve by basically dethroning sex. So our culture no longer thinks sex, like sexual difference, biological sex, is that important, right? And that has then paved the way for something like gender identity to evolve so that my femaleness is about how I feel rather than what I am.
Was Butler interested in dismantling the idea of a binary? Because I presume as a lesbian, she saw herself somewhere on that binary. She's a woman who likes women, right? You have to live on the binary to define yourself that way.
Well, I mean, one thing I would say, you know, not every lesbian is like a Judith Butler-ite,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, but I would say that for her, she does seem to have like a personal investment in this idea of dismantling heteronormativity, right? But certainly Judith Butler and really any postmodern philosophy is all about getting rid of binaries. It was like, man, I can remember taking this, like my first literary criticism class, when we read like Jacques Derrida, it's all about like dismantling binaries. I can remember doing this in college, like, you know, let's read a literary text and like, you know, there are the binaries and let's like swap them around and dismantle the binaries. So it's, yes, absolutely. That's one mode of deconstruction, is dismantling binaries, contesting binaries.
Why would she be interested in doing that, though? I guess it's just like hard for me to even understand, because it's like erasing part of her own self-definition.
I can't really guess at her motivation, right? But I would say, you know, a good faith reading of her is that, you know, her perspective, at least, that she articulates, genuinely thinks that these norms, like heteronormativity, is a method of oppression. Like, it's an oppressive force that marginalizes people, that makes some people other, and that limits people's desires, right? It kind of codifies and tries to label certain desires as bad, certain desires as good, right? And so she's coming from this perspective that, you know, like, there's, I mean, you've got to step into this like completely atheistic space, right? There's no God, there's no like good out there to which we should aspire, right? There's kind of this nihilism at the heart of it. And so any kind of social narratives or social engines of power that kind of exclude certain people with certain desires are bad, right? That's oppression. And what our culture tends to see as natural, that's just a fiction. Now, in her work tends to be, one, it's very hard to read. It's very verbose, and it's just like a brick trying to get through it, right? And also, what tends to happen, I think, especially with the deconstruction kind of theorists, is they're not really making assertions so much as they're like asking questions and making disruptions. You know, they're gesturing toward X, Y, and Z. But I will say for Judith Butler, You know, she does like question the incest taboo, right? I mean, that's a norm. So if you're going to be philosophically consistent and say that there aren't any natural norms, then yeah, you have to let go of things like incest is always bad. You know, she goes there.
And Michel Foucault does the same thing, right? He tried to get pedophilia legalized in France, right?
Yeah, that was kind of the thing back then, the 70s. It was pretty common among intellectuals to have this idea of, like, you know, sexual abuse not being a thing, which if you think historically, right, I think honestly, we've learned so much since the 70s about how harmful sexual abuse is. But yes, there were many prominent French philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and Michel Foucault, who had petitions. They were petitioning the French government to remove age of consent laws. So, and that, you know, that's, I really think that's a fruit of that thinking, right? If we don't have natures, like if human beings don't have natures, if we're just kind of like these blank slates, then yeah, why should, you know, those sorts of things be traumatic, right? Because something being inherently traumatic, that indicates a kind of thing that harms who we are at this fundamental level. So if you're going to kind of try to get rid of the idea of human nature altogether, then it makes it very difficult to hold on to things like certain actions being inherently traumatic.
I mean, I presume that Judith Butler would think that abuse or rape within a traditional marriage would be wrong, right? Because I mean, that's, if we're going back to like a feminism root, how can she define that as wrong, but then erase the boundaries around incest or pedophilia or whatever it may be?
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, that's kind of the classic critique of, I think there are many classic critiques of postmodernism. And one is that, you know, you can't say there are no absolutes and then that itself is an absolute, right? So in other words, like even as she's trying to like deflect truth and deflect meaning and not make any assertions, she is making assertions. Like the claim that nothing is natural is an assertion. So she's trying not to make kind of metaphysical claims about what's real, but in doing so, she actually is, right? So I do think that's a whole. And I think it really reveals that, like, I mean, human beings just have this innate sense that there are things that are true and we can seek out those things and know them. And also there are things that are good and there are things that are bad and we can seek out what the difference is between those things. So even radically deconstructionist philosophers will still be trying to make ethical claims and trying to create, I mean, even this analysis that like power that oppresses is bad, that's a moral analysis, right? That is asserting a sense of what's good and what's bad. So you can't get away with that. Like you really can't get away from that. Sorry, you can't get away from that. And she doesn't, you know, even in her own attempt.
You said earlier that you didn't think feminism has a root. It sounds to me like the root is atheism.
Well, it depends on what, I mean, I would say, the reason I say feminism doesn't have its own foundation is that because you have these different waves and different streams of feminism, like you can talk about feminism that is not atheistic. Like I would consider myself still, you know, I'm a Catholic feminist. I'm, you know, so my foundation is Christianity. And then from that foundation, I can, you know, I can analyze things to get a better sense of what erodes women's dignity in society and what preserves it.
Why even hold on to the word?
Well, that's a great question. I would say I hold it very lightly, right? I think there was certainly a time in my life where it was very important to me. And then there was a time where I really avoided it. And now I think if I use it, I use it because, actually it's funny, what revived my feminist fire is this now widely acceptable notion that anyone who says that they are a woman is a woman. So I think there are very real things in our culture that are eroding women's dignity. I think one of those things is this theory of gender identity that belittles the reality of biological sex. So I do think as a consequence of the fall, right? I mean, if you look at Genesis, one of the consequences of the fall is that the dynamic of harmony between the sexes becomes a dynamic of domination and conflict. And so I do think that that is always at play in some way, and that part of the work of Christianity through the grace that's given to us is to try to reclaim that sense of harmony from the sexes. So when I say Catholic feminism or Christian feminism, that's what I mean, right? And I might use the I might avoid the phrase if I'm talking to people who just really are, you know, not into feminism. But I think it does have a benefit in terms of evangelism as well. I think most young people who go to college will encounter feminism. And so I would rather there be a really thoughtful and deeply Christian articulation of feminism on the table rather than nothing at all.
Yeah, like you're still playing in the game. Even if you have some disagreements with the others, you're still, you know, have a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. With transgender individuals, my read on it has been when I typically see trans men, meaning women who I define themselves as men, I tend to see, I have a lot of pity for those individuals. I see women that have been maybe uncomfortable with their bodies or overly sexualized, and there's a level of trying to escape their femaleness. But what scares me is more so the men who define themselves as women. I think there's a subset of people that truly think they are women, but my read on the majority of them is it's connected to stereotypes of women. It's connected to porn. It's connected to, there is a real mockery of femaleness that is attached to it. And there's a sexual nature to it that kind of, it scares me for women. It scares me for the women in my life. It feels dangerous. It feels dangerous with the men specifically going into women's spaces when there is no doubt a large, there's like a pornification almost. It's like woman face kind of thing where there's a sexual element.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're picking up on factors that are definitely at play. It's hard for me to gauge, you know, how, because most trans people that I've actually met and talked to in real life are not like the activists that you see on the internet who really seem to take up the most air in the room. So part of me wants to say that that's actually a minority rather than a majority. And one of my, like when I talk about the danger of not having sex segregated spaces, I'm not actually primarily concerned about, let's say, a person who's been trans for a really long time, who genuinely has gender dysphoria and is just trying to manage that in life. What I'm concerned about is creating a system that is really easy to manipulate so that those sexual predators who do want to manipulate it, whether they're trans or not, they now have a really easy way to do it, right? They just, it's almost like a golden ticket into any woman's space. And we're seeing that, right? There was just in the, he was in Scotland or in the UK recently, there was, he was a serial rapist who just tried to get, he just kind of suddenly became trans and tried to get access. He requested to be put in a woman's prison. And thankfully, this request was denied. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, right? Like, that's the kind of thing that worries me, is the manipulation of this really gameable system. Because you've got those bad actors who will, you know, kind of game the system. But then you also just have people who are, you know, genuinely trying to figure out how to live with gender dysphoria and all these cultural narratives that are now like, you know, you got to change your body. I do think, though, that the influence of porn is very real here. Absolutely. And that's something I actually want to research more. I mean, there's this whole genre of pornography called sissy hypnoporn, which is it's a type of self-hypnosis for male viewers that kind of gets them basically to self-feminize and self-feminize as a sex object, right? So there's this, there is very much, you know, some people and some trans writers like Andrea Longchu will be very explicit about this, that what it means to be female is to be sexually dominated and objectified, right? And then that becomes almost this like fetishized goal. So that is definitely out there, right? That doesn't mean that every, you know, trans person is trans because of that, but that definitely is a factor in our culture, feeding some of this.
And it's also, it's kind of going back to almost the birth control thing where they're defining themselves by like a very much a male vision of femaleness.
Right. I mean, yep, exactly.
It's so hard. It's such a hard concept to understand because it's like, what does it even mean to feel female? Because you've only felt who you are, right? You've only known your own feelings. I don't know what it feels like to be a dog. I don't know what it feels like to be anything than what I am.
But you can imagine what it's like to be a dog, right? And I think that's what's happening, right? You can imagine, you can kind of project your consciousness and wondering what it's like. But you're right, like you're, because by definition you're not a dog, you're, you know, you're only basing it on your perception of what it's like to be a dog, if that makes sense, because you aren't that. And I think there is a factor here, which I make this argument in the book, that once contraception comes on the scene, once we make that switch as a culture to normalizing the idea that we should disrupt normal physiology for a specific kind of social reason rather than a medical reason, and specifically disrupting women's fertility, I think that really shifts our understanding of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. So prior to the contraceptive era, I think people were just much more conscious of the reality that women are the kinds of beings that get pregnant and men are the kinds of beings that get them pregnant, and that sex might result in a pregnancy, right? But now I think because of the fact that we live in a contraceptive society, many of us use contraception and that's our kind of praxis, that shifts our consciousness about what it means to be a man and a woman. So this whole idea of generativity, this procreative potential that we all have, whether or not we ever actualize it, it's still there. It's like receded in our imagination. So now what it means to be a woman or what it means to be a man is much more superficial. It's about what you look like or about what roles you have in society. It's about these kind of external things that can be mimicked. So I really think that it's only after the shift of embracing contraception that the plausibility of changing one's sex becomes plausible, because it's no longer about this like inherent procreative potential that you can't change. You can disrupt your own, but you can't adopt the procreative potential of the other sex, right?
With surrogacy on the rise, and I imagine that artificial wombs will soon be a reality at least within the next 20 years. Do you see this problem getting worse or getting better as we divorce ourselves from the ability for women to be the sex that carries, you know, children to term?
Yeah, you know, okay. I think in that sense, it will get worse. And I really do think it's important, and this is an argument that Mary Harrington has made, who's a writer and thinker that I really admire. So certainly I would say that the kind of medical transition phenomenon is connected to just the general movement of transhumanism, like the movement toward pushing past our limits through the use of technology. And Mary Harrington makes the argument that contraception was actually the first real step in that direction. And that she's like, all women are then kind of transhumanist in our, not all women, but, you know, women have already kind of made that step into transhumanism. And that's only escalating now with the manipulation of hormones to create the appearance of the opposite sex. And now that's being pushed on children. And you're right, now technologies, they are experimenting with artificial wombs and surrogacy. And yeah, it's a scary world out there. But on the slightly positive side, I am seeing more, even from us, from on the secular side, more feminist pushback on all of these things. I think there is happening right now, which is kind of exciting, this reawakening of women's consciousness to the fact that maybe birth control hasn't actually been that good for us, right? And maybe we should be rethinking some of what's come out of the sexual revolution. And again, that's from secular perspectives, which, you know, there have been, I think, Christians and Catholics who've been making that case for a while, but it's exciting to see books like The Case Against the Sexual Revolution by Louise Perry. That's one example.
That's how I found your book, actually. So I bought Louise Perry's book, and then your book was recommended to me after that. And yes. I loved your the art on your book. So I looked at it and I was like, oh, this is fascinating. So that's how I ended up with your book. But
nice.
Have you seen that research about birth control changing what the type of men that they're attracted
yes.
to?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's so scary.
It is. I know. And I mean, but it makes sense. That's the thing. There's this, you know, it's, I don't know, when I look back at my younger self that never would have thought to critique contraception. Like, I really thought it was, to quote my former self, the linchpin of women's freedom. But then once I was able to, again, just step into a space where I could even ask the question, like, wow, is this good? Like, then all of a sudden it's like, it becomes obvious, you know, it's like, well, this actually isn't, you know, it makes sense then that there are costs to disrupting one's normal physiology. And that's another reason why I'm really, you know, worried about the childhood transition thing. And now what we're seeing, so we, as a culture, we pathologized women's fertility and then we prescribed the treatment of contraception. And now we're pathologizing puberty for gender dysphoric youth. And we're prescribing exogenous hormones and puberty blockers to treat that. I mean, I was listening to a presentation from WPATH, which is the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. So they're the organization that sets all the kind of guidelines and standards of care for trans health. And they had a conference last fall, and I was listening to one of the presentations at the conference. And they were explicit. This one presentation on adolescence was that allowing natural puberty to progress is not a neutral act, but it's a hostile act if it's a child with gender dysphoria. So that was just really fascinating to hear it put in such stark terms, that puberty is, you know, the natural process of simply developing into a mature Homo sapiens is now being seen as a life-threatening pathology that has to be treated with no age minimums. Right. I mean, that's what the standards of care say. So it's really disturbing and fascinating.
Wouldn't it be species threatening to treat them? Right. So they're giving them Lupron, right, which is a chemical castration drug historically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the idea is, I don't know, sometimes it's so hard for me to kind of like get into this. Like, I really want to try to engage with goodwill, you know, so I'm trying to think like, okay. Well, one thing from their perspective, probably, there's already a problem with overpopulation. So if we are, you know, sterilizing a segment of each generation now, let's say 10% of the generation, then that's fine. You know, it's kind of a way of regulating births. I mean, I'm not that surprised that so many adults shrug their shoulders at giving children artificial hormones. I mean, that's what we've been doing to our daughters for decades already. I mean, I was put on the birth control pill when I was 15, 16. I don't know. That's what we do, right? It's like the same kind of line of thinking, the same technological conquest of nature.
Why do you feel the need to engage in the good faith argument? Like, Part of engaging in a good faith argument is the ability for you to come to some sort of understanding with the other side, right? But it seems to me that based off the ideology itself, that's not really possible, right? There's not really much to share when one person believes in capital T truth and the other one does not. And the other one doesn't care with truth so much so that they would change the language they're using just to win. Why even bother? Right. So you have kind of like the good faith approach, or let's say like the Matt Walsh approach, like these people are deserving of ridicule.
Yeah. Right. I guess for a few reasons. One, I've been an ideologue before, and I don't want to be an ideologue again. And I think part of avoiding becoming captured by ideology is trying to make sure that you kind of steel man the opposing perspective, or, you know, you want to be arguing against the strongest version of whatever it is you're engaging with, because it's so easy to create straw man, straw people. Sorry, stupid joke. Arguments. And it's very tempting. It's very satisfying to do so. So that's, you know, that's kind of what I was saying, was like, all right, I want to make sure to steel man this. Now, I do think that probably the majority of people who are caught up in this framework are coming from a place of goodwill. I do think there are some people who are genuinely bad actors, or at least so kind of absorbed in this ideology that they have just completely lost the plot, right? And I think when it comes to like interpersonal engagement, if it's very clear that I'm engaging with someone who literally cannot hear or doesn't even want me to be able to express what I'm thinking, then I won't waste the time to engage with that person, right?
Yeah.
But I think that there are so many people who are in this wide middle ground. You've got the kind of extremists and the activists who have really co-opted the conversation on both sides, and they're kind of busy yelling at each other, while the vast majority of people are kind of like, I don't know what to do with this, right? So I guess I want, you know, I want to be able to engage with those people. And also, I think it's totally fair to ridicule ideas that are bad, but I just think there's something damaging to the soul in ridiculing people. Because ridicule, I think, erases people's humanity. And so even if I, you know, I'm kind of shocked or dismayed at what someone says or does, I still want to remember that, like, that person is made in the image of God, and God deeply loves them. Like, they are beloved of God. And even if I think they're, like, deceived or captured by diabolical thinking, like, I don't want to do damage to my own soul by erasing their humanity, you know? So anyway, it's just, it's hard to navigate. It's often very tempting, I think, to go the ridicule path. And even in the book, you know, I do kind of poke fun at some of these ideas, because sometimes I do think there's just genuinely absurd things that are being asserted, you know, and I have a sense of humor, and I like to kind of play with that stuff. But when it comes to like engaging with people, you know, that's just a little bit more complex.
It's admirable. It's definitely admirable. The hard part is like the leaders of these movements are, the ideology is so, it seems to be two things. It's contagious in a way that I don't understand, and it scares me. But the other thing is that I don't trust the motives of the people leading these people. But what's heartbreaking is when I see the accounts of individuals that have gone down that path, and even sometimes they're not even out of it yet. They're still going down the path of transition. It's heartbreaking. It's a very isolating existence from what I've seen online. You know, I know a couple transgender individuals, but from what I've seen online, it's a very hard way to live, and it is heartbreaking, and I don't understand why it continues to grow, and it seems to be growing in popularity.
I think that's another aspect of human nature, is seeking kind of false solutions for real problems. And there's all kinds of ways throughout history that human beings have done that in bad ways, you know. I know some people, they don't like the comparison with eating disorders, but I do think that can be a helpful comparison in some ways, in the sense that, you know, eating disorders can develop and become this kind of social contagion within certain groups. Like there's almost this, you know, I think that's part of the reason why it's becoming popular. And also just, I really think social media is driving so much of this. There, you know, I've listened to a lot of first person accounts of transition, of detransition. You know, I've talked with people for whom transition's been a positive experience. I've talked with people for whom transition has been a mixed bag. But they're kind of like, look, I'm down this road and, you know, I might not have chosen it, or I'll stick with it, right? And then there are, of course, detransitioners who've been traumatized by transition. And there are a lot of differences between, there are a lot of differences between all of these stories that I've heard, right? So, but one commonality that I will say is universal, or at least in, you know, all of the stories, is this immersion in a kind of online environment where this was really pushed, and that becoming, you know, going into a kind of echo chamber. And, you know, human beings are mimetic. Like, we, by our very nature, I mean, this is how we survive. This is how we develop, is by mirroring people around us. Like, that's how we learn and we grow. So it's a good thing, but it's being co-opted, I think, by the way that social media kind of puts us into these little bubbles and isolates us from the real world. And then we just kind of get in this like mimetic echo chamber, you know? And I think that that's driving a lot of it. I mean, basically, I think what's happening is that this whole range of human distress, I mean, maybe it's trauma, maybe it's, you know, having a broken family, maybe it's, you know, encounters with violent pornography, maybe it's social ostracization, maybe it's having a mental illness, right? Any of this range, just isolation. All of those different kinds of human distress are now being like funneled into this one diagnosis that has a specific treatment path. So I think that's one reason why it's growing so widely, is because it's like this, it's this diagnosis that becomes affixed to things. Then I think without this, gender identity framework would be dealt with in different ways. Because that's a really compelling narrative, right? I mean, imagine you're a person in distress and you go to a therapist, and the therapist, you know, is wondering if you've ever like thought about your gender or whatever. And then you get this narrative that like, oh, this is the one thing that explains why you've never felt at home with yourself, why you've never felt like you belonged anywhere. Like, this is the one thing that explains your pain. And guess what? I know how to solve it. Here's this treatment pathway that will make you become who you really are. Like, that is such a seductive narrative.
Yeah.
It's really appealing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just, it's heartbreaking. I mean, I was just talking to a woman yesterday who has an adult child who's transitioning, but, you know, who has like a serious diagnosed mental illness that includes episodes of psychosis, history of trauma. You know, it's just like ticks all the boxes. And yet no one in her like physician care community is like saying, wow, maybe we should really focus on these other things before we put you on testosterone. You know, it's just like, it's just so heartbreaking to see how this treatment pathway also seems to have become a way for people not to really take the time to figure out what's going on. Like, it becomes a way to just like almost get rid of people who are suffering because it's hard for us to deal with, right? Just put them on that pathway and then, you know, problem solved.
It also, you know, I don't have any evidence for saying this, but it feels like there is an abusive element to it too, because it seems like a lot of the individuals are autistic. It seems like that is somehow connected to, I don't know, that's just anecdotal, but it seems like there's a much higher proportion of trans-identified individuals that identify somewhere on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, it's not just anecdotal. There is evidence for that. Like, so that's a known correlation. And there's some speculation about why that might be. For example, you know, black and white thinking, like either or, like, oh, because I don't fit in this box, I must belong in the other box. just being gender atypical, you know, especially for women who are autistic, they often aren't stereotypically feminine in typical ways. So that I think is, also another, it's not just anecdotal. So there have been some European countries actually who are further down the road than we are in terms of how long they've been doing these treatments, the medicalizing path for youth. Like Sweden, for example, as well as Finland, the UK, and those countries have or are doing systematic reviews of the evidence and are changing their protocols. And Sweden's, I think, the most interesting one. But when the Swedish Board of National Health did a review of the evidence, one of the things that they cite in their decision to change and kind of move away from this medicalizing approach to something that prioritizes psychotherapy is the correlation with autism as something that this is not yet well understood and we need to pump the brakes on this, right? Because, just think about it. Like, what if we're unnecessarily medicalizing and sterilizing like a whole generation of autistic kids?
It's heartbreaking.
We just need to step back for a second and think, what are we doing? What are we doing?
Do you think there's any validity to the idea that it's being pushed because there is a profit attached to these people, that it's the worst instincts of capitalism gone awry, regardless of if it's good or bad for people, that it's being pushed by medical institutions just to drive a profit?
You can't deny the fact that there is a heck of a lot of money to be made on medicalizing healthy young people for life, starting when they're pubescent, that is an incredible engine of profit. Now, to the extent to where individual practitioners or even medical institutions are really seeing this as like a cash cow, that's a good question. I am certainly very worried about it. There is absolutely a profit incentive at play, and that's pretty horrifying. But especially the surgeries. I mean, the surgeries are a real moneymaker because the need for corrective surgeries is pretty high. So, if you do some surgeries, you'll probably have to do more. I know there was that, there was some footage that went around from, in Nashville, maybe, or somewhere in Tennessee, where you actually had a woman explicitly saying, as a way of justifying why we should expand into this area of quote unquote medicine, that, you can just make a buck. You can make quite a buck from, these non-medically necessary surgeries. And that's incredibly dehumanizing. Yeah. Wherever you stand on this, obviously I'm kind of I'm a transition skeptic, let's say. I know the evidence base really well, and it is not very persuasive. But even for someone like me, whether you're a transition skeptic or not, you should want trans people to have the best possible health care. And in order for them to truly give informed consent, they have to be truly informed about what the risks are, what the benefits are, what the outcomes look like, and that's, I don't think that's happening. I don't think truly informed consent is happening.
Why don't you think it's popular for people that are struggling with these desires to treat the mind? Why is that not a popular treatment option, therapy and, getting comfortable with your body or whatever it may be?
It's a lot harder. It's a lot messier.
Is it than the medicalization path?
Well, I think then it's a lot harder and messier than how the medicalization path is presented.
Gotcha.
Right. Because I think what it takes probably a very complex, psychological thing that's happening, and then it externalizes it onto the body as something that can be just managed medically, So there's a, you could, I think there's a sense in which you can feel a lot more control over it. And I think there's something almost like kind of intoxicating or even addicting as well about just the process of watching yourself become this like real life avatar, you know, like the same reason that people might digitally alter a photograph, but you're like digitally, you're actually like physically altering the way that you look in the world. And, you know, a lot of detransitioners I've talked to have said that, you know, at first that's kind of, there's a lot of euphoria and a lot of, you know, they're really jazzed when they start seeing these like physical results. And both anecdotal evidence, but also longer term evidence shows that if there is more ambivalence or regret about transition, that tends to come into effect later. You know, I think there is this kind of initial, like, you know, just feeling pretty jazzed about becoming a new person. I mean, it's so interesting, like, sometimes just thinking about how deeply Christian the promises are that are being made, like this, you know, complete transformation, like put on the new man, put on a new self, you know, like, you know, be totally converted, be made new, right? Like, it's all, you know, it's almost this, it's this like pseudo conversion that's happening, this metamorphosis that you're in control over. You're creating your ideal self. Like that would be pretty cool to see that happening, right? Especially at first. And so I think that would feel more appealing than something like, well, you know, why don't you go to therapy, like have intensive therapy for 5 years while we try to like figure out what's going on, you know? Even though that's more truthful, right? That's more truthful because human beings are incredibly complex. And you can't just have a 30-minute conversation with someone and know the root of their pain. It's actually more truthful to say, we got to take some time to figure this out together, you know?
It's like the crash diet. It's like the magic pill. I'm going to lose all this weight fast, but then you immediately go and eat a pizza.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the strange parts about transgender ideology is the compulsory requirement of others to participate in it in the form of pronouns or whatever it may be. Obviously, the people that are participating in it won't want to be called the correct pronoun because that's how they feel. That's what they feel respected as. But do you think at a root level, that's a power thing to get people unsure of their footing of reality? To it almost perpetuates the ideology in the participation of using it. It makes you question the reality that you see with your own eyes.
Yeah, it's like self-hypnosis in a way, you know. So I think one thing that's happening is that these kind of proclamations of identity are more precarious, I think, than ones that are just based in unavoidable facts of our existence. Like, these identities need to be validated continually in order to be real. And everyone around you has to participate in that validation, right? Or else, you know, the truth kind of rears its head. And if we think back to that conversation we were having about postmodernism and how, like, reality is a construct of language, well, that's what's happening, right? There's a particular reality that is trying to be constructed, and it requires the linguistic participation, not just of the person, the individual, but of everyone around that person. And that's something you see, like if I, you know, sometimes I'll look at like online forums, you know, like Reddit and things like that. And it's remarkable just kind of looking through a lot of the different posts, how many of them are about getting validation from other people that they are, you know, quote unquote, really a man, or that they look like a man, or they are really a woman, or they look like a woman. In a way that's like, does, you know, seems almost pathological in terms of like adult development. You know, I can remember being that way in like junior high, you know, and you just like everything, you got constant external validation. But this, yeah, it really seems like you have to be surrounded by people who are, you know, validating this in order to make it seem real.
Do you think the thing that remains attractive about it is just the magic pill of the whole thing? Is that why it continues to grow? Meaning that it just solves all your problems? Because it surely does not look like an easy path. And I would have to imagine if somebody felt like that, they have to see other people struggling with this existence.
Right. I do think there is a lot of... I think that the narrative about how awesome transition it is pretty like carefully curated. There's also not a lot of room for people who are really wrestling with doubt. Again, if you look in the online forums, doubt is often called internalized transphobia as a way of kind of like whisking it away. I also think that because there is evidence that if, ambivalence or regret, doesn't happen immediately, like it takes a while, I think, especially for some of the more serious physical effects to kind of set in. And also for the kind of like euphoria of transformation to settle and then to be like, oh, wait, this is probably it. Like, this is probably as far as my body's going to go. Like, this is as deep as my voice is going to go, or this is as, buff as I'm going to get. And then it's just this for then, the rest of my life. And I'll just be getting kind of an older version of this, an aging version of this. Like, it takes a little while for, I think, that to kind of set in. Now I forgot your original question. So it takes a while for regret to set in. What were we talking about?
Magic pill. Why it continues to be attractive.
Oh, yeah, because even though, yeah. So one thing I think that people who are considering transition are often protected from the kinds of stories about ambivalence and regret. Like, there's just a lot of, detransitioners don't really exist. Let's not talk about their stories. And also, I think that once you're like pretty far down a road that you've committed to, detransition is really, it's not necessarily clear that that's always the best outcome, right? There's a cost to that too. If you detransition after not a lot of time of transitioning, then some things will be reversible, but a lot of things are irreversible, and you're kind of in this liminal space. And then for some people, I think it's easier, even if it's like not as amazing as you thought it would be, to just kind of continue with it, right?
It's like Scott Nugent.
Yes, exactly, right. Yeah, I mean, Scott's a good example because it would be really disruptive to his family. It would be disruptive to, like, certainly any kind of reversal surgeries. Like, that would be a no-go health-wise. A question is, like, I really think maybe a value that I think is a good value is this sense of, like, bodily acceptance, right? Which I'm kind of like, wait, where did the bodily acceptance thing go? Because I feel like for a long time, it was this like, especially for girls, like, there's so many ways to be beautiful. You should accept who you are and like accept your body, And now all of a sudden it's like totally switched in this odd direction. But, there's the question for the person who's, transitioned for a long time. Like, what does bodily acceptance look like for that person, right? If they do come to that place. So I do think there's just a lot of nuance and complexity in this question.
Well, the story that you shared at the end of your book, talking about your postpartum body, was really affecting. And I thought it would be helpful to somebody. It's helpful. It's not just a transgender thing. I think it's helpful for anybody that struggles with their body. I thought it was a very powerful example of how to think about, to kind of root your body in purpose almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I do. I mean, our culture is so image obsessed, and we're confronted with images of ourselves in ways that are kind of unimaginable, like just a few decades ago. I mean, even right now I'm talking to you and I'm like looking at my own face,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's like, I can't get away from my face. So it's no wonder that a lot of people start to perseverate on it. I mean, plastic surgery is a big industry you know, not just for trans people, but for plenty of non-trans people as well. I mean, it's just so wild to think about, like, I can't, like, there was someone, I heard an anecdote recently that there's this French saint named Saint Bernadette, and something about how, like, she never even saw what her own face looked like because she was really poor and they didn't own a mirror, you know, and she died kind of young. And it's just remarkable. Like, she just never.
It sounds nice.
It does sound nice, actually, because I think there's this that kind of disrupts our self-perception, because it's like an objectification of the self. Like, we begin to think of our bodies, especially, as this like avatar that we have to kind of project our ideal sense of self or identity onto, rather than just this kind of given thing that we don't really have all that much control over.
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Because I know you probably spent a lot of time writing it because it was beautiful, but I wonder if you wouldn't mind making the case. Your the opening of your book talking about Genesis and the biblical understanding of the complementary nature of the genders. Would you mind trying to make that case right now? Because I think it was really powerful, and I think that it would be helpful for people.
Sure. So in the, I think it's the second chapter of the book, I do kind of an in-depth reading of the first three chapters of Genesis, so the creation accounts in Genesis. And I compare them against the backdrop of the Babylonian creation epic, which is called the Enuma Elish. And basically, the Enuma Elish is this wild story of this creator deity, Marduk, who conquers this primordial sea goddess and creates the universe out of her corpse, and then kills her lover and creates human beings out of her dead lover's blood. Okay, I think I got that right. So it's a very violent creation story, and there's this primordial conflict between the masculine and the feminine, and the universe and human beings are created as this like afterthought, like, oh, as the like frenzy of battle clears, Marduk is like, oh, what can I do with this? I guess I'll create a cosmos, you know? So, this would have been kind of the dominant cosmology around the time that at least the first chapter of Genesis would have been written down for the first time. And it really, if you kind of have that backdrop, it really brings out some parts of Genesis that I think people, if we're too familiar with them, they get kind of lost. Like the fact that creation is orderly, it's intentional. It's patiently called into being by a God who's like, this is good, right? There's no battle. There's no conflict. We don't get battle and conflict really until the fall, right? And one thing that's really striking, so I think the Enuma Elish doesn't even mention sexual differentiation in human beings, right? So human women, females, are not even mentioned. They don't even get a cameo in the creation story. But if you read both the account in Genesis 1 and then the creation account in Genesis 2 and 3, if you pay attention to how sexual difference plays a role in those stories, it becomes clear that the differentiation of the human being into male and female is the culminating creative act in both accounts. And in most translations, you can actually notice this because it's when the language jumps into poetry instead of prose, right? So both when in Genesis 1, when it mentions the creation of the human beings in God's image, male and female, he created them, like that jumps out into poetry. And then in Genesis 2 and 3, when you have the first recorded words of a human being in scripture, it's when Adam says, at last, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman, for from man she was taken, right? So that's another jump into poetry. And if you really look at that second creation account especially, there's a lot of dramatic buildup to the creation of the woman. Because first, God is like, he creates this human being, and then he's like, there's something missing, right? So that's the first time in either creation account that there's a sense that something's not good. And it's the fact that at this point, we don't have sexual difference. So then, you know, the passage talks about God creating all these different creatures and then bringing them to Adam to name them. But none is found that fills this absence that's there until, you know, God puts the human into a deep sleep and then creates woman out of that human. And one way of reading that is that actually that first human being wasn't yet sexually differentiated. It was like an earthling, you know, and then that deep kind of ontological sleep, what's brought out is a male human being and a female human being. And then you have those words, ish and isha, spoken for the first time in the text, male and female. And again, it's the culminating act, like now everything's good, right? And that's incredible, especially when you compare Genesis to other creation narratives, how elevated sexual difference is as this good and beautiful God-given thing. It's really remarkable. And there's also this sense in which the text holds on to a tension between difference and sameness, right? So when Adam sees the woman for the first time, or when the man sees the woman for the first time, he recognizes by her very nature that she is both more like him than any other creature, which is why he's like, at last, like this isn't a monkey or a gopher, like this is a human being like me, like at last. Bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, right? The sameness, they share this. But then there's also this difference, right? She is woman and he is man. So there's this difference and this sameness that's both. Their difference makes possible this communion that is life-giving. And then that chapter ends with everything being great and no one felt ashamed. You know, it's just this beautiful sense of harmony and relationality and beauty and wonder at last. And then the fall disrupts that harmony and that communion. And one of the points I make in the book too is that, we do have to reckon with the fall, right? We could talk about the created order, but it's true that we live in a world that is corrupted by the fall, where things are twisted in ways that they weren't meant to be. And we experience that in our own person. And that's real, you know, it can't just be kind of wished away. But at the same time, like when in the Gospel of Matthew, I think when Christ is questioned about marriage and marriage norms, he doesn't appeal to the law. He doesn't appeal back to the law of Moses. He appeals back to Genesis, you know, and I think that shows something important, that in the redemptive order that is opened by Christ, the original harmony of Genesis is also kind of opened for us again. And like through the grace of God, we can begin to correct the work of sin in our lives, you know, not in a way that's ever fully complete in this life, but still in a way that that is important and that is real. So that's kind of the gist, I guess, of the Genesis chapter.
No, it's great. That was my favorite part of the book. It was really beautiful. You did a great job with the book. The book is The Genesis of Gender, A Christian Theory. It's fascinating. It's really, really well done, and you're a beautiful writer.
Thank you.
Where can people find you?
Find me? I don't want people to find me. No, I'm just joking. I am on Twitter intermittently, but I do have a Twitter account. And so people can follow me there. I don't know, like just Google me, whatever, you know, I've done a lot of podcasts. So, if you like search my name in a podcast thingy, things will probably pop up. I don't know. I write things. I've written three books, but the first one I wouldn't really recommend. That was my PhD dissertation. I mean, you should skip that one, but I wrote a conversion memoir a few years ago too, that talks in more depth about my own kind of personal spiritual and intellectual journey. So if that interests you, it's called Into the Deep, an Unlikely Catholic Conversion, and then The Genesis of Gender. Both are available on Amazon as well as other places you get books.
Perfect. Abigail Favale, The Genesis of Gender and Into the Deep, available on Amazon, and we'll link to them in the podcast show notes. Thanks, Abigail.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.